Welcome to EIR Talks. This week, we feature Dennis Small, the Ibero-American editor of Executive Intelligence Review. Small addressed the joint conference of the ICLC and the Schiller Institute on February 18th of the year 2001. Here's Dennis Small, whose speech was entitled, This Little Piggy Went to Market.
The first presentation tonight, I've given the title, This Little Piggy Went to Market. I know it's impolite to say I told you so, but we really did tell you so. I mean, if people had been listening to Lyndon LaRouche, they would have known that this was coming, and now it's actually happening. From May of this year, the NASDAQ has plummeted by approximately 50%, and this is just the beginning. It's going down. Those of you who have attended past conferences of ours know that we warned you of an imminent debt blowout. Globally, we pointed to the examples of what was going on in Asia in 1997, and we said that this would, in fact, be occurring in other parts of the world. Now that kind of a debt blowout is, in fact, happening in the United States. We warned you that the kind of energy crisis, which we demonstrated and documented for countries such as Russia over the course of the 1990s, would be coming home to the United States. It has now come home to the United States. We documented for you the manufacturing layoffs and massive unemployment breaking out in countries such as Mexico as a result of the IMF policies going on there. We warned you that these kinds of things would be happening in this country as well. Now this, too, has come to the United States. We have entered a new stage of the global financial crisis, which Lyndon LaRouche has been warning you about for quite some time. And the new stage is not simply the fact that this is now hitting the United States with a vengeance, but that the process itself, which has been going on globally, is now beginning to manifest itself inside the United States as well. Up till now, to a certain degree, the United States itself has been kept afloat, or rather the bubble in the United States has been kept afloat by a process of looting going on from all parts of the world. That looting process is, of course, continuing. However, that looting process is now beginning to implode inside the United States as well. And the United States, which has become the importer of last resort for countries around the world, absorbing through the financial bubble, which we'll document a bit further, the imports from country after country around the world, that role which the United States has played is now ending. And this, among a number of ways, is one of the ways in which you're going to have a domino effect in which the entire meltdown and disintegration of the financial system is going to spread like wildfire throughout the global financial system. Now, we began to enter this new stage in the period beginning in September of 1998 with a bailout of LTCM and the Brazilian bailout in January of 1999 following that, in which a hyperinflationary process was unleashed by the policies which were determined and decided upon in the United States with the guidance for this, financial guidance for this coming from London as usual. We entered into a hyperinflationary zone because, as LaRouche was explaining to us earlier today and yesterday, the process of rolling over debt which was coming due required the issuance of monetary and financial aggregates greater than the amount that was coming due over that period itself, such that the process of the bailout itself produced a bigger problem than it was solving in this process that you can see in LaRouche's typical collapse function, where the two upper curves cross over each other. Now, this type of hyperinflationary process, this new period, this new stage of the global financial crisis, is beginning to evidence itself, for example, in the oil, the energy crisis, the electricity crisis, which you've heard about and felt about and so forth in the case of California and elsewhere, which you'll hear about in much greater detail in the course of this evening's discussions. Now, the reason I wanted to start by saying that we told you so is that there really is a very fundamental issue here on the question of LaRouche's forecasts, because as this process is going on and people see around them now that what LaRouche had been telling them would occur has in fact occurred, you begin to get a very interesting kind of reaction. And I'm sure many of you who are out there organizing are familiar with this. You will get people who agree with what LaRouche has to say towards the past. but not towards the future. Now, this shows a very interesting kind of problem, because they're perhaps willing to recognize that LaRouche must have been right about something to be able to tell you before about what has now in fact happened, but they absolutely don't want to believe that what he is saying is now going to occur is in fact what is in store for them. And you will get all sorts of reactions to this of different sorts, such as, well, that's true because of this, but that won't be true because of that, or they'll say, oh, they will solve this. They with a capital T, that's all you know. You don't know who it is, but they will somehow solve this. And what I want to pose to you from the outset of this evening's discussion is that the real issue in this difficulty that people have in conceptualizing LaRouche's forecast and his forecasting method is a very profound problem, and not a simple one, not one of simple solution. That the real issue here is that people have a disagreement or a problem as to the actual nature of the physical economy and of the humanized universe within which that physical economy develops or doesn't develop. And whether or not the nature of that humanized universe is in fact susceptible to forecasting. In other words, is it in fact possible that different trajectories of outcome can be based on different action, different human action? And this actually poses a very basic question, because the problem is that the concept that most people have of the physical universe and of the human economy developing within it is of a universe of either one of two options, either of fixed laws, which are linearizable in some fashion or other, both towards the past and towards the future, but which are linearizable, and therefore within that kind of basically materialist framework of one sort or another, because physics is, after all, a question of material bodies moving around, there is in fact no room for free will. That is to say that there is no real option of different choices of trajectory of human activity that can change the outcome. And that's ultimately what's behind one of the views of the problem that people have with this issue of LaRouche's forecasting. And that leads to a certain kind of fatalism, which you're certainly familiar with, where people say, well, it's going to be what it's going to be, and there's no way you can actually change this, and that's where it's going to head, and that's the way it's going to be, and so on and so forth. There's a problem in the comprehension of the nature of the physical universe and man within it, which is the underlying problem on this issue of LaRouche's forecasting, I propose to you. The flip side of the same coin is the people who view the universe as fundamentally arbitrary. That is to say that there is no causality whatsoever in point of fact, that there is no causal relationship between activity within that universe, and that for that reason, or if such causality exists, it's not knowable to man, and for that reason, the art of forecasting or the science of forecasting is something that cannot actually apply looking towards the future in this universe in which we reside. And I'm posing it this way because I think that the solution to this problem, to this issue, is actually the key to understanding both the cause of the crisis which we're facing today, and also it is the only possible basis for founded optimism that there can indeed be a solution, that there is an answer to this thing. In other words, what I want to get at today is two points. First of all, man is not a piggy, nor is the economy a market. So there's absolutely no reason for this little piggy to go to market. And I want to proceed on those two points simultaneously. Now, let's take a look at the bubble. This is just the U.S. side of the bubble. This is the upper of Lin's three curves in his triple collapse function. This is the United States situation, and it's the best estimate that we have been able to come up with, that in consultation with the two leading experts in the world on the subject of derivatives and financial aggregates and so on that were available for my consultation, whose names I cannot mention to you because both John and Richie will be speaking later in the panel. But the best picture on this thing that that we were able to actually pull together on the U.S. side of the situation is that you're talking about, over the period of 1980 to the year 2000, a growth in the U.S. financial aggregates from approximately $7 trillion, this is all in trillions, back in 1980, to approximately $134 trillion today. Now, the lion's share of this, as you can see by just a glance, is the blue curve underneath, which is derivatives, financial derivatives. Those now total approximately $85 trillion out of the $134 trillion total. The other two major components are total debt of all different kinds, corporate debt, personal debt, government debt, and so on and so forth, and the capitalization value of the stock markets in the United States, which have grown prodigiously, as you know, in the United States over this recent period. Now, derivatives are approximately two-thirds of the total. The interesting thing, however, is that if you look at this this curve, the period from 1996 to the year 2000 shows a phenomenal rate of growth on an annualized basis of derivatives in particular. What you're getting is approximately a 30% per year growth rate. Now, if your cancer, if your speculative bubble is growing at the rate of 30% per year, you can imagine what's going to be happening with the economy. Now, the next transparency takes a look at this same upper curve in the triple collapse function, but globally, internationally. And what you see here is that the global financial aggregates, LaRouche threw out recently, a number of months back, that the total volume of financial aggregates internationally is approximately $400 trillion. Now, so I figure we're only $25 trillion off, because he's undoubtedly right. These estimates is the best that we could come up with, taking a look at what is pretty much visible on the horizon. So that all that this means is that there's things that are not visible on the horizon. But we're in the ballpark of approximately $400 trillion here. Again, of the total of $375 trillion, $280 trillion of derivatives are sitting out there. And just look at the way this thing has grown. This has, again, been growing at approximately 30% per year internationally. In this case, you not only have the debt of the G7 countries, or the so-called advanced sector countries, and not only the stock markets of those countries as well, you have, in addition to that, on this graph, we've included the indebtedness of the developing sector, the third world countries, right? The less developed countries. They have many names. 5 billion out of 6 billion people on the planet Earth are represented in those countries. Now, this is actually interesting, because you cannot actually see on this graph the amount of that debt, because it's dwarfed by the size of the rest of the financial bubble. In fact, if the total amount of the foreign indebtedness of the third world countries in real terms is approximately $4.5 trillion, only $4.5 trillion. And if you look at the next transparency, you'll see that this is actually a dwindling percentage of the total global financial aggregates. And this tells you something about the political process that has gone on between the 1980s and the year 2000. In 1980, the first pie chart, you can see that the foreign debt of the developing sector was approximately 6% of the totality. Blue is derivatives. It's the other thing to look at. Look at how the derivatives have taken over the whole pie chart. But 6% of the total financial aggregates globally back in 1980 was the third world debt. Now, there is a reason why the center of the financial political battle in 1980, 81, 82, and 83 revolved around the issue of the foreign debt of the third world countries. And LaRouche's proposal for Operation Juarez was going right at the center of the most explosive part of the global financial system. Because although it was merely 6% at that point, in point of fact, it was the only part that was in imminent blowout back then. Today, look at the situation in the year 2000. It's less than 1% of the total financial aggregates. $4.5 trillion, merely, out of about $400 trillion total. Everything is blowing out. This isn't a question only of the debt of Mexico or Argentina or Russia or so on blowing out. No. The stock market's blowing out. The derivatives are blowing out. The banks are blowing out. The national debt of the United States is blowing out. Everything's blowing out. the whole kit and caboodle. There is no solution to this problem unless the totality is addressed. Nothing less is going to work. And this is something that I think is important to keep in mind as we analyze and evaluate proposals such as those coming out around the Jubilee 2000 and other proposals. Very important. This issue of the third world debt is very important. It's nations, after all. This is the debt. This is the way the global cancer is sitting on the backs of 5/6 of the world's population. Not a small matter. And it's all transferred in through that mechanism. However, it's not the whole story. And you cannot solve this problem only by issues such as debt moratorium, by issues such as addressing the debt of these countries, and so on. The steps taken in that direction are useful because it poses the issue, but it's not the solution. There is no solution outside of LaRouche's total New Bretton Woods reorganization. And anyone who simply takes a look at the magnitude of this thing has got to immediately realize that that, in fact, is the case. Now, if we take a look at the next transparency, I have a picture for you of what has happened with this, the official foreign debt of the third world nations. You can see that it has grown over the period of the last 19 years up to about $2.5 trillion. This is the official foreign debt. You will also see a leveling off which occurs over the last year or two. It's deceptive. The reason it's deceptive is that over this period of time, what has been happening is that the official foreign debt categories have been, shall we say, supplemented by other forms of de facto indebtedness, which bring, as the next transparency shows, the total real foreign debt of the third world nations, the developing sector nations, up to approximately $4.1 trillion in 1999, closer to $4.5 trillion today. Now, this debt started out as about $645 billion back in 1980, and as those of you who are familiar with our previous discussions of bankers' arithmetic will realize, we have a case here where over this 19-year period, these countries have paid $1.6 trillion on $645 billion in original debt. In other words, the original debt was paid about 2.5 times over. And the total debt now is, about 7 times larger than it was initially. So again, in typical banker's arithmetic, 645 minus 1,613 leaves you with 4,137 in debt. Typical banker's arithmetic. And that's the world picture in that regard. Now, one of the things that has happened along with this process of the third world indebtedness is a political process to convince the victims of this indebtedness that the way to solve their problem is to privatize and deregulate. You might have heard that recently in certain states in this country. Privatize and deregulate. It's going to work, they tell third world countries. There's no problem. It's important to do this. Globalization is with us. You've got to open up your economies. You've got to open up the doors. The world is new. Open up the doors of your economy and allow all the capital to come flooding in and help you out. And, of course, they open up the doors and all the capital goes flooding out. And they privatized, hear this, Californians, they privatized in the third world, in the developing sector, between 1987 and the year 2000, $400 billion in assets, national assets, oil companies, electricity companies, mines, and so on and so forth, which they sold for a song on the market. They got the dollars for it, and the money didn't stay in their economies for more than a split second and went out immediately in the payment of the debt. And this privatization process and this deregulation process is exactly the same kind of argument that is being made today. All right? And they say, well, you can't go against the current on this thing. I mean, these are the rules of the market. This is how things have to go. You can't get the market upset. Why, Mr. John Q. Market will be disturbed with you. You know, you used to hear about John Q. Public. Now it's John Q. Market. You sort of wonder, who is John Q. Market? So I did an internet search, and here he is. Okay. This financial bubble, all $400 trillion of it, is the cause of the hyperinflationary explosion which is already underway globally and inside the United States as well. Now the United States and states within the United States are being told that what has to be done in order to deal with their problems also is to privatize and deregulate. And this is what's happened in California. Now, Richard is going to go through the energy situation in California in some detail. I just want to make one or two basic points on this. First of all, the reason that electricity rates has risen in California has absolutely nothing to do with supply and demand. The reason is that there is a gigantic speculative bubble, a cancerous bubble, which is riding on every single kilowatt of electricity produced and sold in the state of California. That's why the prices are so high, because on every single unit of physical production which is moving in that economy, what's riding on that is this gigantic cancer of speculative debt. And to the degree to which you don't challenge the existence and the dominance of that speculative debt, that cancer, and allow it to exist, there is absolutely nothing you can do by way of supply or demand or anything else to deal with the problem. You can double the number of kilowatt hours of electricity produced in California and it won't affect the price $1. Won't make any difference because the price has nothing to do with the amount of kilowatts being produced. Almost no relationship whatsoever. Unless you stop the speculative cancer, unless you re-regulate, unless you say we will not allow the cancer to dominate the markets of our physical economy, we're going to close the door to the cancer. Unless you do that, there's absolutely nothing else that is going to make any difference whatsoever. There is nothing that's going to work unless you re-regulate, because re-regulation is the name that's given to smashing the door closed on the cancer and saying, sorry, not here. That's why it's got to be done. Now, of course, what people in California are being told is, no, the problem is supply and demand. The issue of the reason that the price has gone up is because the questions of the market and supply and demand, and you just don't understand this because you haven't really read Paul Samuelson's textbook on economics, because if you had, you would know that what's really going on is that supply is limited and demand is increasing, and therefore, as every reader of Samuelson's textbook knows, and as you can see on the next graph, prices rise when supply and demand, the circle on the bottom is the price level determined where the S curve, which is the red one, intersects the blue curve, which is the blue one, and that's the market-determined supply and demand price. And when supply is limited and restricted, and that's shown by the shift of the supply curve into that purple one, slightly to the left, well, as you can see, the new supply curve intersects the demand curve at a higher price, doesn't it? And anyone, if people had only read their Samuelson, would know that this is what's obviously going on in California, and that's what's going on. Well, I have read Samuelson, I'm ashamed to admit. So, now they tell you, well, no, if you'd only read Samuelson, you would understand this. But, you know, you got to ask yourself, well, where does this demand curve come from? I mean, it's a little bit of a question. Where does the demand curve come from? How do you know the amounts that people will demand? Aha! Did you know that demand curves come from individual indifference curves? You didn't, did you? Okay. Figuring that you were uneducated on this subject, I have drawn two indifference curves for you. And suspecting that you're a little undereducated, I'm going to read you what Paul Samuelson has to say about indifference curves. Quote, page 443 of the Fat Book. Thank you. The curved contour of figure, in his case, 22.5, linking up the four points, I drew six, is an indifference curve. Every point thereon represents a different combination of the two goods. In our case, on the y-axis, electricity, much in demand, and on the x-axis, Pokemon games, also much in demand. And the indifference curve, Samuelson says, is so drawn that if our consumer were given his choice between any two points on it, he would not know which one to choose. All would be equally desirable to him. and he would be indifferent as to which batch he received. Right? In other words, you're willing to trade off approximately 3 Pokemon games for 2 units of electricity. And since there is a diminishing marginal utility of Pokemon games, you are willing to give up less and less electricity the more and more Pokemon games that you get. And that's an indifference curve. That's why it's shaped that way. The batteries are not included. That's in Economics 102. I don't think they're ready for that, Paul. Now, unless you think that Samuelson and other economists have a static view of the world, no. They have a view of dynamic equilibrium. And what that is, that you take 2 static moments and you connect them with an arrow. That's dynamics. And the way you get a global demand function is that every one of us, each one of you, has an indifference curve. You know what you like. Nobody else knows what you like, but you like it. I know what I like very much, and I choose in proper combinations what I like. I like some electricity. It's important, but I like Pokemon games too. And when you get into the more sophisticated classes in economics, you need a third dimension to include the batteries for the Pokemon games when the electricity goes out. Okay, that really is what they say. That's where, I mean, anyone who studied economics in any university, anywhere in the world, knows that I couldn't possibly be making this up. This is what they teach. This is where the demand curve comes from. Okay, fine. Let's subject this to a small empirical test, 3 tests. First, we're going to look at the question of oil, because after all, we were told, weren't we not, that the price of oil plummeted a couple of years ago because the market was flooded with all sorts of oil and supply and this, that, and the other. Now, if you look at what happened between 1996 and 1998, where the price of oil goes plummeting down by a percentage, which is actually a 52% drop in the world price of oil, over this 2-year period, the supply of oil over that same period rose 6%. Now, I ask you, do you think that a 6% increase in the supply of oil produced a 52% drop in the price? Well, the economists would say, well, that's because there's an extremely inelastic demand curve. I know you're wondering what the inelasticity of demand is, but we won't get into that today.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll return in a moment with more of Dennis Small. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with more of Dennis Small, the Ibero-American editor of Executive Intelligence Review. Small's speech, which we continue here, was entitled, This Little Piggy Went to Market.
Let's just look at what happened in the next year, between 1998 and 1999, and then in the year 2000. Well, the price of oil, as we all know, zoomed back up by an increase of 120%. And according to the theory of supply and demand, this would be a result necessarily of a vast contraction of supply that would drive the price up. Now, the only problem is that supply rose in this period by 2%. Well, slight problem. Let's look at the next transparency. Natural gas, U.S. natural gas. Look at what happened between 1990 and the year 2000. The price of natural gas rose by 52%. Because supply contracted dramatically? I mean, how bad is your eyesight? Flat? Zero. Zero. Okay, let's look at California electricity while we still have the lights to run the projector. Here you have it. from May, this is an index of 100 of May, in May, actually it goes back to August of 98, but it also hits 100 again in May of this year, of last year, 2000. From May 2000 until the end of the year, 7-month period, the price of electricity per kilowatt hour in California rose by about 700%. The supply, it may look like it didn't collapse at all, because we do know that the price goes up when the supply goes down. It just looks there like it didn't contract, but it actually did. It fell over the same time period by 0.15%. So much for Samuelson. And so much for the nonsense you hear about what's actually going on. What's going on is something else. What's going on is what LaRouche told you was going on. Now, let's for a moment take a quick survey of, on a global scale, the physical economic curve under the triple collapse function. That is to say, we've looked at the financial aggregates globally. Now let's look at one or two elements of the physical economic parameters underneath. Here we're using 1990 as an index of 100, and we're looking at what has happened between 1990 and the year 2000 in two areas. This is grain production in the developing sector, that is to say, all of the third world countries, 5 billion people out of 6 billion people. And what you have in this situation is a 10% collapse per capita in grain output. In physical economic terms, while the speculative bubble has grown, as we indicated previously, with a derivatives growth rate of about 30% per year. Electricity, in this case, is electricity consumption in the CIS countries, the former Soviet Union countries. And there you have a collapse of 26%. Now, it is the case, and it's correct, economically, scientifically correct, to not show global averages on this thing, because the global averages actually disguise the truth of what's going on. Because the fact of the matter is, as you can see in the next transparency, that what you have going on globally is a kind of income skewing process, which is very similar to the process which is going on in the United States, which Richard Freeman and others have documented. You know, the famous 20%, 80% graph. This is a global international equivalent of the same thing, where the upper 15% in income bracket of the world's population, measured in GNP terms, is now getting approximately 80% of the total income generated globally, rising from 70% 20 years ago. And the lower 85% of the world's population, 5 out of 6 billion, is getting a decreasing share measured in GNP terms. Now, let's not take this too far. This is GNP. This is done on national averages. It doesn't tell you the whole story. It's not physical economic terms, but it does give you a doorway to look into what the process is that's actually going on. This is world poverty in the middle of the 1990s. Again, as measured in income terms. The middle of the 1990s, because I don't have figures for today. And what I want to say from the outset is that it's far, far, far worse today than what you see here. I don't know how much worse. Maybe Paul will actually tell us a little bit about this. But each bar represents 100% of the population in these four or five major areas of the world. In Africa, the red part of the bar is the percentage of the total population which makes or lives on, that's lives in quotes, $1 a day or less. In the case of Africa, it's approximately 40% of the population. The yellow part of the bar is the part that lives on $2 a day or less. In Africa, 75% of the population survive, quote unquote, on $2 a day or less. South Asia, the percentages are 43 and 70%. East Asia, 26 and 70%. And Ibero-America, 25 and 50%. So you can see in the majority, most of these parts of the third world, you're talking about approximately 3 billion people out of 6 billion people on the planet getting $2 a day or less. Now, this correlates with a lot of things. One of the things that it correlates with is life expectancy. And again, these are older numbers. Paul, I think, will have an update for us on this. And it's only getting worse. In the case of Africa, your life expectancy is 52 years. These are World Bank numbers that I'm dealing with here. And so on across. The last column, AS, is quote-unquote advanced sector. Now, what this means is that the capability of the economy, of the global economy, to maintain a growing and prospering population as measured by the central concept in LaRouche's economics, potential relative population density, that potential relative population density of these societies, all of our societies, is less than the actual population. Therefore, the population collapses. We are in a demographic implosion, a hyperinflationary explosion and a demographic implosion where the population cannot be maintained. And it shows up in a variety of different ways. Number one, people die. Total population is falling, number one. Number two, life expectancy is falling. And number three, the quality of the population as reflected in skill levels and things of that sort is also diminishing. Now, there is an additional feature to this population demographic question as it relates to the importer of last resort that I want to throw out to you, which is, you know that Mexico exports 90% of its product, of its exports to the United States. Richard will document for you the situation in other countries, China 40%, other countries 30%. But this is their physical export. Many countries also export their population. There are 8 million Mexicans in the United States. And the next transparency, you can see what this means in terms of its labor force. It's 8% of the population. It's 12% of its labor force, which has emigrated to the United States. The United States is the importer of last resort, not only for products, but for populations. What happens when the importer of last resort collapses in that regard as well? What we're looking at is a global society in the process of demographic implosion. What's the deeper issue? The deeper issue was posed by Lin in, among other places, a recent article of his appearing in EIR magazine on look at what's happening in Brazil, discussing the WWF attack on the LaRouche organization in Brazil, where in the course of that discussion, LaRouche says the following. I'm going to read the paragraph of which this is just one of the selected quotes. He says, societies can be characterized into two types according to their relationship in the relatively closed area that they inhabit, in their relationship to the noosphere, that is to say, the living physical universe which they inhabit. Societies in which the localized noosphere is developing anti-entropically, growing, typify one of the two types. Societies which may prosper at home by looting populations and regions abroad constitute an opposing type. Okay? There's two types. Those that develop anti-entropically and those which may seem to prosper at home by looting abroad. Now, I think pretty much everyone in this room will have little difficulty recognizing and agreeing and admitting that we are, in fact, today in the second type that LaRouche is talking about, in this type of process of collapse. But you often run into the problem as to whether the first type of what LaRouche is discussing, that is to say, societies in which the localized noosphere is developing anti-entropically, is if this is, in fact, possible on a permanent ongoing basis, perpetual basis. In other words, can man have such a relationship to the physical universe around him, to the humanized nature within which he develops, where that relationship can be bounded at any given point, but infinite in terms of its self-development? Is the physical universe such that it complies with infinite human creativity? That's the issue. Now, some people say outright, no, of course not. That's ridiculous. You can't keep going on this way. Man can't do this. Who do you think you are? Man is not God, after all. Prince Philip tells us with great conviction that man is a virus. You can read in Luther that man is a worm. You can hear some people tell you that man is a barking dog. Some people in economics classes argue that he's a piggy. And so they say, no, it's absolutely not possible. Now, a contrary view might perhaps be, well, no, we can do something about this after all, because as you develop and as you grow and you begin to exhaust your resources, you run into a problem and you then have a crisis, or you have a crisis like today, and the circumstances are so critical that somehow or other man comes up with a solution, and creativity is there, and so on. And after all, necessity is the mother of invention, isn't it? Right? Wrong. Necessity is not the mother of invention. Invention is the mother of necessity. And that's a crucial distinction which I want to take recourse to Plato and his Timaeus to develop that idea a little bit, because, again, I believe that this is the only possible standpoint from which one can understand what got us into this mess and what is the basis for founded optimism for getting out of it. Invention is the mother of necessity, and that is the way the universe is actually organized. Now, in the Timaeus, happens the day after the discussion in the Republic, after Plato and Socrates have laid out what the proper form of organization of a republic actually is. And the issue taken up in the Timaeus is the origin. It's the story of creation. It's Genesis. Others have written about Genesis too. Plato wrote about it in the Timaeus. And it's the story of creation, or of Genesis, as told by Timaeus, an astronomer. Interestingly, an astronomer. Remember the slideshow you saw from Bruce earlier in this conference. Now, the starting point of the discussion of the Timaeus, epistemologically, is actually where Plato leaves off in the Theaetetus, which is on the issue of what is the nature of knowledge? How do you know what you know? And it begins with a brutal assault on the idea of sense perception. And what Plato says, through Timaeus in this case, is that sense perception is absolutely false, and that the only basis for understanding actual causality in the universe, of what's actually causing things to occur, is reason. And Plato says the following. Timaeus says it, it's written by Plato. He says, "What is the difference between that which eternally exists and has no birth and that which is always coming into being and never exists? The first, that which eternally exists, the first, being eternally invariant, is comprehended by mentation with the aid of reason. The second, which is ephemeral and never really exists, is imagined by opinion with the aid of unreasoning sense perception." Okay, so that's the starting point of the discussion. So then Timaeus says, okay, now let's take a look at, from that starting point, what in fact is the cause? What is the origin? What is the story of creation? Where did this all come from? What's the cause of it all? And he says, "We also say that what comes into being must necessarily come into being by some cause. To discover the creator and father of this universe is quite a task." And at this point, Socrates interjects. Socrates does not speak very much in this dialogue. This is heavily a monologue. This is heavily Timaeus going through the whole story. But Socrates interjects at about that point. He says, "Excellent, Timaeus. And we must by all means agree to do as you bid us. We have heard your prelude with admiration. Now do go on with the theme of the music." And I suggest you recall some of the discussion of music in this regard, because Timaeus will start discussing the creator of the universe as the composer of the universe. So Socrates says, "Very good, Timaeus, go right ahead, take it on. Timaeus takes a deep breath and says, "Okay." He says the following. Let me tell you then for what particular cause the composer composed this creation and this universe. He was good, and the good never has any envy for anything. Being thus beyond envy, he willed all things to be created as like himself as possible. Whoever accepts this foremost and most pervasive principle of the creation and the universe, when it is offered by thoughtful men, is accepting it wisely. Now, I mean, this is pretty stunning. This, what does he call it? This foremost and most pervasive principle of the creation of the universe is that God created it good. That God was good, and he wanted it to be good. That's the starting point. That's causality. Now, having said that, Timaeus then goes on to explain, next transparency, for this consideration, he framed the universe by composing mind inside soul and soul inside body, so that he might produce a work most beautiful and most perfect by nature. In other words, that's why he did it that way. He wanted it to be the most perfect and beautiful by nature. That's why he put mind inside soul and soul inside body. In this way, according to the language of simile, we ought to say that this world was created by the providence of God as a living organism truly possessing soul and mind. Now, I ask you to think about what LaRouche has been discussing over the various discussion periods about the way in which the cognitive process is the organizing principle from which life flows, and life in turn is the organizing principle from which the non-living flows, and not vice versa. This is what Plato had to say about exactly that topic. Now, Plato has posed here that the universe is composed of the non-living, the living, and mind, and that mind is the higher ordering principle of this. Okay. So far, so good. Then Plato, Timaeus, restates his conclusion. Let me just comment, however, that this idea of a single living organism and of the universe functioning in this kind of way really reminds us powerfully of Leibniz's concept of the best of all possible worlds, right? That God created it in the most beautiful and perfect way possible. That's what Plato says, and that's reflected subsequently in a different kind of elaboration from Leibniz. And this is also this idea of the role that mind plays in the living universe shows up in Nicholas of Cusa, for example, in his dialogue, because it is a Platonic dialogue, The Layman About Mind, where he discusses this quote, which I have here, from his 1450 dialogue, The Layman About Mind. Cusa says, "Mind is a living substance. Its function in this body is to give it life. And because of this, it is called soul. Mind is a substantial form of power." So I think you can certainly see the way in which Leibniz and Cusa were absolutely Platonist, Platonic in the content of their philosophy, even with this brief reflection. Now, then, like I said, Plato summarizes the conclusion up to this point, and he says, okay, the body of the universe was created visible, but she, the soul who partakes of reason and harmony, was invisible, created the most perfect of ever conceivable and existing creatures by the most perfect creator. Okay. But then there's an interesting change which occurs in the dialogue, because Timaeus introduces the following idea. He says the creator, the composer, was very happy with what he had done so far. He was overjoyed, in fact, by it. And he loved it very much. You may hear echoes of other discussions of Genesis written, which appear after the Timaeus, in Plato's words. He says, "When the father who conceived it imagined it moving and alive and a delight for the everlasting gods, he loved it. And overjoyed, he conceived a plan of how to render it still more like its exemplar," i.e., like himself. to make it even more like its exemplar. And since the exemplar is an eternal being, he set out to complete this universe as closely to that as possible. Okay? But now there's a problem here, because he can't make mind or man eternal in the same way God is eternal, because then he'll be God. But he wants to make it more perfect still. Why? Because he really loved what he had done, and he was overjoyed by it. So what did he do? What would you do? What does he do? Anyone have any ideas? He created time as the moving image of eternity. Listen to it in Plato's words. It's really impressive. He says, given that the nature of the exemplar is eternal, and given that it was impossible to perfectly bestow this eternal quality on a thing which is generated, he invented some moving image of eternity. So at the very same moment in which he set the heaven in order, he also made an eternal moving image of the one and unmoving eternity, an image which moves according to a metric. And this metric we have called time. Think back to what Bruce was showing you in the movement of the skies, of the stars, the celestial bodies, and the way in which man sees his own actual eternal nature reflected in the movement of time, not in the clicking of a clock or the ticking of a clock, but rather in the way in which time has been created by the composer of the universe as a metric to make eternity simultaneous with his temporal existence. That's why God did it this way, according to Plato. I find it quite plausible. I certainly don't have a better idea than that one, or certainly not a more beautiful one. I'm very struck by this idea. Now, that being the case, having gone this far, having done this, and by the way, later in the Timaeus, Timaeus the astronomer tells us that that God set the planets in motion and the orbs in motion as the means for measuring this presence of eternity as measured through time. That's why the planets orbit the way they do, is for that reason. But then Plato returns to this discussion of the relationship between this most perfect of creations and the actual physical ephemerals which are visible to man's senses, or present to man's senses, not only visible, those things which seem necessary. And he says the following: absolutely nothing which the act of becoming bestows to the changing realm of the senses belongs to eternity, since these are the forms of time which imitate eternity and revolve according to a metric. Now, this is the point that I wanted to get to, because Plato says, okay, how does all of this relate to what's going on in our knowledge and our understanding of the physical universe? He says, well, look, mind and soul are clearly the highest forms of the created universe. He says, for it must be said that of all beings, soul is the only one that has the right to possess mind, because soul is invisible, while earth, air, fire, and water are visible. For it is necessary that the lover of reason and knowledge seek the first causes of rational nature. Very good. So he's going to seek those first causes of rational nature. And then he says that the following: because the birth of this world came forth as the mixed result of the coming together of reason and necessity, necessity of the material objects moving in the world of the ephemerals, because of that, reason rules over necessity by persuading her to drive the greatest part of the ephemerals towards what is best. and our universe was initially put together when necessity was defeated by rational persuasion in this fashion and by these principles. Reason rules over necessity and drives it to the best result. Translation, if I may be allowed, invention is the mother of necessity. Not problems which arise from necessity somehow create from within its bowels some creative breakthrough and invention. It doesn't work that way. No matter what you were told, it works the way Plato is saying. And since invention is the mother of necessity and not the other way around, Plato concludes that man is indeed, as Leibniz, to paraphrase Leibniz, man is the crown of creation. He is the absolute crown of creation. And the next transparency is Plato's formulation. God gave each one of us a divine genius, that which, as they say, inhabits the highest part of our body in order to uplift us from the earth toward our heavenly kinsmen. Since we are an offshoot, not earthly, but heavenly. We are not a virus. We are not a worm. We're not a piggy. We're an offshoot heavenly. And this ain't a market out there. It's an economy. And for that reason, there is no reason whatsoever for this little piggy to keep going to market. It's time for a change. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to EIR Talks with Dennis Small, Ibero-American Editor of Executive Intelligence Review. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.